Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we're blessed to have one of my favorite return guests. We're going to speak with Miss Lynn Taylor, and she's been in the trenches being our advocate and being our kind of a canary in the coal mine, in a sense of finding out what's going on in our education system. Unless you have a child in school, unless you really pay attention to what's going on, it's become, I don't know how to put it, Lynn, a wild west, basically, where I said before we started the show that it's not about education anymore, any more than medicine is about healthcare. And unless you know what's going on, you cannot make conscious decisions for your child. And the things that I'm reading, it's really becoming very adversarial, where the parent is being basically stopped from parenting because it somehow encroaches on the power of the school. So today we're going to speak about a lot of different things, but I wanted to first welcome you back, Lynn, because I know you're so busy and it's a pleasure to have you back on.
Oh, well, thank you, Dr. Elena. I tell you what, I always love hanging out with you and being able to inform your audience on all these things that they probably are not hearing anywhere else.
I know that. So let's get right into it.
You know, sure.
From the healthcare perspective, we did see an expansion of Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act plans. And from that standpoint, it affected our healthcare delivery system, how people could access it, et cetera. But my understanding is Medicaid expansion also affects education. I've never heard of that before. How is that working?
Oh, well, I'm so glad you asked. And let me go back just a little bit for folks so that they can get the entire picture. And back in 2015, when the Every Student Succeeds Act was passed into what I call de facto rule, because it is an unconstitutional law, one of the things that was roped in with it was the Title I funding was recalculated. And if folks don't know what Title I funding is, that is the per pupil money that was set aside for those with special needs or those with behavioral problems or those who were somehow in need of what the school had deemed an intervention. And with that recalculation, it went from per pupil need to the entire school. So that's where we first saw, that's where we saw a big increase in the Medicaid funding that was going to the school. Now, let's go back a little further than 2015. We can look back to Senator Robert Byrd from West Virginia, because he was the one who way back when said, hey, you know, we need to put Medicaid funding into schools. So it's been there for a long time. It's just the fact that when the Every Student Succeeds Act came along, instead of it going for those students who supposedly needed it, it went to across the board, say everyone needs it, and we're going to either over-medicate you, over-diagnose you, or we're going to use a combination of people who are not quite medically trained enough to know what they're doing to handle these students. And what we've seen happen since then is that there's been a huge increase in interventions, overprescribing of medicines that aren't working, treatments that are not keeping the student's best interest in mind, and it's actually eroding the family.
You know, when I think about our education system, you know, the way it's set up for public schools, I thought the only monies that were coming in, well, not the only, but the main monies, was from property taxes for use for textbooks and the inner workings of the school. The fact that we're now expanded into healthcare, where you're right, there's not doctors in the system, there are no healthcare professionals, it's administrative people. And I remember when my mom was a teacher, they would, well, after she left, pretty much, they were diagnosing children and saying that if you don't give your child this medication, they can't come to school. And that was that came from the teachers. Mm-hmm. And so what it sounds like is this expanded that power
absolutely.
To treat. Well, who has a license for this? Is this coming from HHS? Who's deciding on what gets medicated and who gets diagnosed?
Oh, that's such a great question. Well, let's see. In the Every Student Succeeds Act, the Health and Department of Health and Human Services got the largest power increase, then the Department of Labor, and last place was the Department of Education. Wow. And so what we're seeing, because it came under one of the sections that was known as safe schools, it was decided, well, we need more school psychologists, we need more school clinicians, we need more school social workers. And what we saw was the absolute blending of Medicaid, CHIP, all those sorts of programs come into the school where they really hadn't had that much of a presence before. Now, I do have a list of the examples of these school-based health services that we have seen increase. But let me just, before we go into that, let me just say that we are seeing some medically certified doctors and health practitioners be employed by our schools. But by and large, there are others who are fast-tracked into being able to say, well, Johnny and Susie needs A, B, C, and D. And sometimes we're seeing where it's the teachers who may be medically qualified or may not be having to pull double and triple duty on this. So it really begs the question of who is doing all this diagnosing, and what are they diagnosing, and what happens when, you know, Johnny or Susie has a bad day? They're going to take this one assessment and it's going to label them for life. That's totally, totally unfair and a violation of their civil rights and their right to privacy. But let me give you a little list, and I say that very tongue in cheek, of the examples of school-based health services that we're seeing. And this will be under Medicaid and CHIP. This will also go into Medicare as well. All right, all physician services, all nursing services, all psychology services, all counseling services, all social work services, all vision services, all audiology services, all speech therapy services, occupational therapy services, physical therapy, examples for mental health, psychological psychological assessments, I'll get it out, psychosocial assessments, individual psychology and counseling, group psychology and counseling, medication administration, peer support, and case management.
That's a mouthful.
Yes, it is. That's why I got tongue-tied.
Well, you know, it sounds like an extension of a healthcare facility.
It is.
And
it
really
is.
Like more like a psychiatric facility.
It is. It is. And I tell you what, here in North Carolina, we have had many, many people saying, oh, yes, we need to take all these former bed facilities that were for substance abusers and turn them into these mental health clinics. And, you know, I'm not saying that we should do that or we shouldn't. I really think that there needs to be a closer investigation before we just go lumping everything into, oh, yes, this is a great thing. Because here's one of the things that this expansion of Medicaid did, was it said your providers can be, it doesn't say they must be, it says they can be first on the list, credentialed, then certified, then licensed, and finally registered. Now, in my mind, the way I've seen healthcare work, especially for my children, is that I want someone licensed first, not someone credentialed. I want someone licensed. Mm-hmm. Because in our education system, if you're credentialed, it's a fancy word for a diploma. No, if I want a surgeon, I want someone who is licensed as a surgeon, not someone who is credentialed.
That's a good point. I mean, it's like they're taking anybody that they can put into their teaching education system. I mean, you're basically like teaching for a test, right? So you're learning what, it's not even child behavior per se. It's how the child interacts with you and other children in the class. Lord knows, a middle schooler, kindergartner, high schooler, these are not adults. They have all sorts of quirks. And I can imagine, just like in healthcare, there's an algorithm. You know, you're teaching to a recipe. Mm-hmm. And if the child somehow is disruptive, whether that it's too easy for them, so they talk, or they don't like the class, whatever the thing is that keeps them out of the conveyor belt mentality, they're about to be labeled. Is that a good way to see it?
It absolutely is. Now, let me go back a little bit in history for us to the Every Student Succeeds Act. This was probably, maybe just before, it was about 2014, I believe it was, Dr. Elena. This system that was already set up for per pupil had to change so that it could go over to whole school, meaning universal screening. And anytime in healthcare or education we hear universal screening, that means anybody and everybody connected to the school system. And this is why I'm saying it's trying to erode the family, because the door doesn't stop at who's in the classroom. It follows the child into the home as well. But around 2014, as part of this system to go from per pupil to whole school, was free care expansion that allowed your states to bill for services beyond a child's IEP or individual education program. Now, that is huge, because when that free care expansion opened up, it opened up Pandora's box so that schools could qualify as not only an educational center, therefore getting education funds, but also a quasi-federally recognized medical center to start receiving more Medicaid funding, thus being able to double dip into the Medicaid system. Now, here's the kicker. That shouldn't have happened. And this is something that we're seeing happen because, like I said, since 2014, your schools have had the option to draw down additional Medicaid funding dollars, including the CHIP, which is the Children's Healthcare Insurance Program. So, this is huge. Now, we know that COVID has gone on to exaggerate this need for Medicaid. So this is why we saw an increase in Medicaid and Medicaid services, especially through the Bipartisan Safer School Act. Now, this cloaked a massive expansion of data tracking on Johnny and Susie and Johnny and Susie's family. And this is also where they were saying, oh, well, we're not going to stop with Johnny and Susie's family. We're going to go community-wide with this, and we're going to bring in partners, whether they're in the medical field or even somehow could possibly be thought of as connecting to the medical field. It also made that school-based health centers and school employed providers could also take advantage of this overreach in funding. It also set up what is known as the EPSDT, and that stands for the Early Periodic Screening Diagnostic Treatment. So all these assessments that these kids are getting, whether they realize they're getting them or not, because 9 times out of 10, they're on a computer and it's through a biometric algorithm, they're getting slammed with this every single day.
Well, I think that's just a mouthful. I want people to just digest this for a second. So let's take our first break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living in Solution. We're speaking with Ms. Lynn Taylor. And prior to the break, you were doing a wonderful job of explaining this network, this spider web of control. And I can imagine just one wrong diagnosis, one wrong assessment, leading to catastrophic problems. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, if a child has an issue or somehow the parent somehow gets pulled in, it's something going on in the home, would that trigger some visits to the house by CPS? Would it, I mean, in California, for example, they're trying to pass a law where if the child has a gender dysphoria and wants to change sex, whatever, parent is against it, the school overrides that and can take the child out of the household, and the parent wouldn't even have a leg to stand on. And they can do this even behind the parent's back. Once that's legislated in, that becomes de jure. How do you fight something like that? And is this a slippery slope to that phenomenon?
Oh, it absolutely is, but it's not just California. I mean, this was set up to be a national activity because, again, we have to see that the parents don't get to parent anymore, that the school somehow is more qualified to be that parent. But let me point out this, that nationally, Medicaid has an impact on our schools through a program that they've come up with called the Healthy Schools Campaign. Now, back on February the 9th of this year, this particular Healthy Schools Campaign hosted webinar that was called The Momentum for Expanding School Medicaid. And in that particular webinar, they told you that there were going to be major investments, Dr. Elena, from both Congress and the Biden administration, and that what schools needed to look for to be able to take advantage of this expansion of funding that is on the taxpayer's dime was to expect new federal guidance. Now, let's point out, first of all, that guidance is policy, and policy is not law. Law is something that is concrete. Policy would be the leaves that fall on the trees, as fall from the trees onto the concrete. So if you have one tree that's an elm, that leaf is going to be different. But if you have one that's a pecan, that leaf is going to be different. So our policies, depending on where they're coming from, are going to be different. But this is telling us that we're going to have new federal guidance. And what we've seen happen in education is that anytime the federal government says, oh, well, we're going to guide education, what they mean is not guiding. It means mandating. They're just going to use a nice word so that it won't feel so bad when it happens. Now, one of the things that I wanted to point out about this particular webinar that this Healthy Schools campaign did was Hewlett-Packard Foundation, the Kaiser School Health Corporation, and other supporters. Now, Hewlett-Packard Foundation is in on the Common Core. Kaiser is part of Kaiser Permanente, which is a big partner of the CDC. And we saw what they did with the adverse childhood experiences. We've done that on other shows of ours, and how it was saying that, well, we need to get in the mental health business for students' sake. Well, let's think about that. School is not the place for mental health activity. That would be between your child and your doctor, who is a licensed mental health professional. But the whole guise of this, and this is a first in three series webinar that they're going to bring out, Dr. Elena, was to improve student health and wellness by giving them supposed better access or equity into health care that they couldn't otherwise get. It would also reduce absenteeism. It would also give everyone a better leg up because it would give them an early identification for intervention needs. And then here's the kicker. It overall will bring about better health and education outcomes. And the reason I want to focus on the word outcome is because anytime we see our government or a government entity or partner use the word outcome, what that means is not you having an end that satisfies you, but an end that satisfies whoever's in charge. So it would be the Medicaid system or the education system at this point. So Johnny and Susie would not be able to do what they wanted to do. It would be what the school and the healthcare system dictate.
That's amazing. So the individual choice, individuality, pursuing your own destiny is completely eradicated in the system. Because someone gets to decide your talents and, quite frankly, your worth. And if you want to talk about diversity and inclusion and all this other equity stuff, it's only going to apply to people who have to access the public school system. Or will it also apply to private schools?
Oh, this is meant for every student. And every student means whether you're in public or your private, parochial, homeschool, hybrid, you name it, magnet school, whatever. This does not stop at grades K through 12 either. This is meant for cradle to grave. Now, let me just say that healthaffairs.org had an article that was called 20 Years of School-Based Health Centers, because I know that was one of your questions. And I did some research, and here's what I found, that from 1998 to 1999, there were only 1,135 schools across America that were known as health centers as well. That increased to 2,584 schools from 2016 to 2017. It was the government's logical response for equity, and the Medicaid expansion helped this number go from 1,100 to 2,500. So they're saying, oh, goody, this helps. So when we have this latest round of Medicaid expansion, what do you think they're going to do with this? They're going to increase that even more. So let me just leave this little bit of information for you. This particular movement has blossomed even more since it was recognized as a federally qualified health center. 10,629 schools and over 6 million students thus have been served. We include telehealth as well.
Man, so, you know, I know that they're about to change Medicaid. So there's not a lot of money left for your typical Medicaid, a physician-based service outside of a school system. I'm starting to wonder now, are they going to pull that money out from the community where people are actually accessing it with real healthcare problems and concentrate that money in the school in the mindset of, if we get people early, we can control the outcome of health disparities and health out, you know, diagnoses outside of that. It seems to me that they're going to try to pull that.
Oh, no, there's no trying. That is the goal. That is the goal. That was the goal that Rockefeller had in mind with his Resilient City movement that does butt up to this adverse childhood experiences, because the mindset was, well, if we can eradicate every bad thing that ever happens to anyone and we can service them and all their needs through a community network, school and healthcare and jobs, then we're going to have better productive citizens and we'll be able to reduce the pupil to prison pipeline. Well, in the cities that this has actually been tried on, Dr. Elena, what they've seen is an explosion of homelessness and joblessness. So the very things that this particular program was supposed to do hasn't happened. And here's another thing. If you try to cut out every single bad thing that ever happens to any person, we would be doing nothing else, because what might be a bad experience for you may not be a bad experience for me, but this is going across the board. And if you look at the surveys or the questionnaires that these children have to answer about, you know, what's going on, it's, what are mom and dad doing to you? Is anyone forcing you to eat food you don't want, or making you go to church when you don't want to? Or is anyone, you know, abusing you? Is anyone having a gun in the house or taking drugs or drinking alcohol? Or are they smoking? And if so, what are they smoking? I mean, things that are frankly none of the school's business. Mm-hmm. That is part of what is on these particular assessments, because the mindset is we're going to just have a Pollyannic view of what a government-controlled life is going to look like, and we're going to try to sell it to you. Again, here in North Carolina, for example, where I live, the Medicaid expansion brought about $1 billion for mental health and substance abuse, with funding for inpatient community care facilities and support for those in mental health crises. It would also integrate mental health and primary care in our schools. Now, here are the figures. $225 million of that billion goes to behavioral health treatment reimbursement. So think of your multi-tiered support system or your positive behavior intervention systems and supports. Think about all those interventions about, you know, you didn't handle this situation right, Johnny or Susie, so we're going to come in and we're going to show you that your behavior is all bad and here's how to make it all good and everybody can get along. $175 million of that $1 billion goes to behavioral health, mental health in schools, as well as primary care. North Carolina's preschool system will get doubled down on, because it will also use money to pump into the education system to the higher ed ages as well, especially in the healthcare tracks. It will also see an increase in school psychologists, social workers, and counselors. You know, that's just one state.
Let's take a break, our second break, because what you just said is actually quite chilling. Because it just makes everybody into a patient at some point if they're outside of any of these parameters. So let's take our second break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living in Solution. We're speaking with Ms. Lynn Taylor, and you can go to her website, commoncorediva.com, and you can actually look at everything she's been doing, podcasts that she has, what she's written, various blogs. And you always cite your source, Lynn, which I love about you, because you just don't say things. You actually do the research and you're putting in the time and the legwork for folks. And in this day and age, if you don't want to be curious, if you don't want to handle your own business, then you are going to be a victim. You're going to get caught up in whatever they're trying to pull. And it's a common denominator through all of this, demonizing us, making us into sick people, whether that's from a healthcare perspective, mental, or whatever they can do to put you into their system. And one thing I noticed that you didn't mention, but I think probably underpins this. Mm-hmm. Once you get this diagnosis, I would say that most of this treatment is not going to be by speaking to somebody. It's going to be being medicated. Is that a way to think about it? Because that's what it is. Evidence-based medicine is prescription-driven.
Right. It absolutely will. And we need to understand that since this Medicaid expansion happened back in March of this year, that it expanded coverage to nearly every adult, Dr. Elena, with incomes up to 138% of the federal poverty level. So for a single person, that's going to be, you know, about $20,000. For a couple, $27,000. For a family of three, $34,000. For a family of four, $41,000. So think about that. If you happen to be a family that's larger than four people, I'm not sure how this would impact you. But this is saying that we're going to expand coverage to nearly everyone. It also includes D.C., even though it's a district, it'll say 41 states. It will tell you that these particular states have already accepted the expansion. Now, remember, I use the state I live in as an example. But here we have Texas, Wyoming, Kansas, Tennessee, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and South Carolina. And excuse me, these are the states that have not taken it. I'm so sorry. Every one of these states has not taken it. Let me make sure that I preface that. I got my notes mixed up. Texas, Wyoming, Kansas, Tennessee, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, and Florida. Now, they haven't yet, but that doesn't mean they won't, because again, you cannot expect a draconian measurement like this of your government to work if all the states don't somehow kowtow to that. So I just wanted to make sure that I did point that out. And I do apologize that I got my notes mixed up.
No worries, but there's still the same mentality. I'll give you the healthcare part of it. At some point, they wanted to have a compact for your medical license. I think Medicaid was trying to do this, where if you license in one state, you have a license for all states, which means you no longer have autonomy as a physician. So if they cut your license for whatever reason because you don't toe the line, then you can no longer practice medicine. And we fought that pretty well. So they let it go. But this to me is like, a slippery slope. As the children go, so will every other aspect of our system. And as they become adults, they don't even know what good is. So they're not going to fight anything.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, we need to understand that part of this Healthy Schools campaign, they have a collaborative that is several states strong. Now, I don't know how many of the states belong to this, but it's called the Promising Futures Learning Collaborative. I'll repeat that. The Promising Futures Learning Collaborative. And it is all in this particular system. But here are some questions that I would hope that parents would be asking when they hear all this is, what happens to my informed consent, especially for my child who is a minor? Or what happens to the privacy rights of my child? Or what about standardization of these privacy rights? Because that is probably going to have to happen too. I mean, how else would you be able to wrest control from the parent if you didn't try to standardize some of this? So those would be some questions that I would want folks to be asking their school system or their healthcare provider, because those are huge.
Those are huge. And is it the other unanswered asked question is, if I put my child in the public school system or any school system, am I automatically by default giving my consent to this? And that's what you mean by informed consent. It's not written. It's just, you know, passive. You put your child in it, then by definition, you're saying it's okay for them to do these things to your child. And I just want to take a step back. All of this concentration on young people, on the education of our children, what happens to the people who are now out there who actually need this? All the homeless that are sitting there with obvious mental illness, they don't care about those people, seems to me.
You're exactly right, because, and this is one of the problems that I've had with this, is because you're taking things from those who truly need it and giving it to those who don't, but because they have fit some sort of cookie cutter mold, oh, well, we're justified in doing this. Now, one of the reasons why I wanted to bring up North Carolina as the example and then look at your other states is because part of the sales pitch for this Medicaid expansion is, oh, well, it's going to boost healthcare and it's going to boost the job market. So our economy is going to be really good. And oh, yes, by the way, we'll be able to save lives. Why is it, and this is something that I would hope parents would ask as well, why is it that the saving lives didn't come first? If this is so great for Johnny and Susie and Johnny and Susie's family, why didn't that come out first instead of dead last? But what did come first? Jobs. What did come first before that? A way to get more money. Now, one of our representatives, his name is Donnie Lambreth. He's one of the top budget writers for the entire state. And this is a quote. You don't have to use it for health care. You can use it for education. You can use it for other critical state needs. My idea around it is to use it for some mental health ideas, end quote. Now, this was featured on WRAL-TV. I do not have the date, but what a horrible thing to say about this is a politician's way to state, here's how I'm going to abuse the Medicaid system.
He's telling you right in your face what he's going to do.
Absolutely.
But the outcomes of how the children are performing academically, those don't seem to be on the front burner anymore. These kids, I mean, after COVID, there's been across the board a decrease in the productiveness and the academic fitness of children. They can't read or write like they used, like they're supposed to. And they're acting out all over the place. Excuse me. There's nothing to be said about that, is there?
Well, not really, but you know, here's the strange thing. That's what we're being told. Has anyone really, really gone beyond the headlines to see if that's really true? Because, you know, the people that I have been able to talk to was they've been able to do much better because the people were able to see what was going on with their children's homework, or they were able to help them with homework, or they were able to help them. But again, when you have a system that is not geared towards student success, but student stumbling and student failing so that they can come in and be the savior, what do you expect? Yeah, the news supposedly is all bad that COVID did this and COVID did that. But you know what? I question that heavily, because from what I see, this is all going according to plan, which the overall goal was to get mom and dad out of the way so that the school could be the parent. And if you doubt that, go look at the track record of what has happened since Common Core has been instilled. It absolutely is horrible. But what we are seeing that is very, very disturbing is that parents are going, well, you know, maybe if I do something to help my baby have a better chance at life, maybe that's the way that I can go. So I'll look at gene editing their brain so that I can have them get into a better school and they can do better on the SAT and they can do better later in life and we'll have better school access. Now that, my dear, is absolutely horrid.
Yeah. That's, you know, some sci-fi stuff right there. So are you saying,
I wish it were, but the research that I have found, it is not only being suggested, there are people who are trying to make it happen.
So correct me if I'm wrong. From what you're saying that they're going to use, I guess, Medicaid expansion monies to, I guess, fool the parents into thinking that we can somehow, from a gene editing standpoint, using quote science, make your child a better student, a better citizen, have no hurdles, but it's going to come at a cost of they have to do this.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, it will. Now, back in 2022, in September, Axios published an article where they were telling, oh, we've got multi-million dollar gene therapies, and they're mainly focused on gene therapy for cancers and other diseases. But, and here's the big but, Dr. Elena, drug development pipeline is in full swing of gene therapies. And the FDA could by 2025 approve 10 to 20 gene therapies every single year that will involve big pharma and big insurance. And the big question, Medicaid could factor in, but it would have to be done very carefully not to implode it, because right now at least 2,000 gene therapies are in the works and a huge portion of the population is on Medicaid. So think about this. How easy is this going to be for big pharma and big insurance to find a way, Dr. Elena, to take advantage of all that supposed free money from Medicaid?
For sure. I mean, it's a free money to them. They'll be paid in advance. But the way you're breaking this out, once it becomes a mandate, this is a slippery slope again. You start off small. It's all about helping and having people be healthy. The next thing you know, your child gets diagnosed with an issue, depression or anxiety, gender dysphoria, whatever. Right. And it's going to be a gene therapy that's for it. And in order for your child to go through school or for you to keep your child, you'll have to acquiesce to these treatments. And I'll let you answer that when we come back after the break, because that sounds like where this is potentially going. So let's take our last break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Ms. Lynn Taylor, and you gave an absolutely chilling assessment of some underpinnings or foundations that are trying to be set. And I gave an example of how I thought it could roll out. Does that make sense to you, that if they're able to mandate the health of your child by whatever they desire to be the treatment for it, right now it's probably medication for ADHD and reassignment with hormone-based treatment if you want to be a boy or girl, etc. But do you foresee that that was just the beginning and that they could, you know, mandate things like gene therapy for behavior? Your child is not behaving properly, they're a little aggressive, they have a mind of their own, or they're a problem, and this is what you have to do to keep them in society or keep them in school.
It would not surprise me, but think about how many years it's been, Dr. Elena, since we learned about the horrible, wretched experiments done on human beings to bring about some of these very same things. And we're going to sit here in modern day America and embrace it and say, bring it on? Are you kidding me? It's absolutely terrible. Now, like I said before the break, Medicaid could factor into this. Right now, I want to point out, though, that the current genetic coverage under Medicaid, all cancers, inherited mutations of cancer, and the Lynch syndrome, which is a form of cancer. Beyond that, right now, it's not covered, but that doesn't mean that it couldn't become that way. And let's point out that back in 2017, the American Medical Association published something. It was on ethics and the genome editing. The CRISPR-Cas9, which is done to correct heterozygous mutation in human pre-implantation embryos, in other words, genetic engineering, can be used ethically when it's done to ease suffering and disease, because it could be reversed and it could be used for therapies as well. And this is their big but. However, ethics should deny gene editing for desirable characteristics or improving existing genes. A potential for abuse is too prevalent because it becomes manipulation. This will also bring about risk for health of future generations when one person is edited, and doctors are not prohibited to do this, but ethically they should not. And then, of course, there's always that little caveat that says, but certain conditions could allow. And then it goes on to tell you that if you're interested in finding out the principles of the American Medical Association on medical ethics, to see ethic number 1, 2, 3, and 5.
I mean, this is, it's already being done, isn't it? I mean, there are parents who want a boy or a girl, and they're using things like gene editing and, you know, all sorts of things to get eye color, hair color, etc.
And where have we seen that before?
Not in places that we want to live, that's for sure.
Well, not in political systems we want to have either, but exactly. We might as well be there. But, you know, I don't know how much time we have left, Dr. Elena, because where the rest of this leads is so hurtful just to talk about it. And I don't have little ones, okay? But I can't imagine a parent-to-be or a new one going, hey, yeah, sign me up. But that's what we're seeing happen. And I wanted to, you know, approach all that. So I don't really know how much more time we have, if we need to do a part two of this discussion. Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure where you want to take it from here.
Well, I think we do need to do a part two, but I wanted to whet people's appetite as to
sure.
consequences okay. of these things.
Okay, so well, I wanna let's do that then.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's okay. backtrack, because my mantra is always follow the money. And during sure. COVID, that COVID money went to school boards. It mm-hmm. went to these administrative people who probably don't even have children in the school system, but they're making money on this. So my question is, what are the school boards? I know they were getting COVID money. Or do mm-hmm. they stand to gain from this type of control?
Oh, I don't see why not, because if you'll remember, the whole goal is to eradicate the school board, because then everything will be decided for the local communities by the federal government. I mean, that's the whole wicked part of the school choice argument that no one is wanting to admit. But I will tell you, till the cows come home, that is precisely it, because the whole goal is to cut out every bit of competition outside of public school, shut it down, rebrand it as public, put it under the federal government's thumb. I mean, the blueprint has been around since the 80s, and it's taken that long for this to happen. And people are just chafing at the bit right now to listen to all those people going, oh, yeah, but, you know, school choice is going to give me money that I can use to educate Johnny and Susie in any way I want. What they don't understand is that money is going to be used against them for control. It's a poison carrot on a stick. But the more sinister is that it removes the representative form of government, especially where school boards are concerned, because they won't be needed. They'll be obsolete because you won't need them. When everything is public education, there's no need for a school board. There's absolutely none, because the control was taken away from you. But if you want to whet people's appetites for part two, here's the kicker. February the 10th, 2023, the American Wire News reported that there was a recent study done that roughly one-third of American would-be parents were open to genetic modification of their babies to gain access to an acceptable school.
That's tragic, literally. I mean, do they not realize that once you make a change genetically, there is no going back? And as opposed to what these people who are for gene editing think, you cannot control what God made. There's, there's an unintended consequence. You may insert something, and then something else that was suppressed gets activated. And mm-hmm. once it happens, you can't change it. Will you be able to have children if you've been gene edited? Yeah, it's a big question. You know, will this go generation to generation? Will it change the human race? These are questions that are really basic that nobody seems to ask. It's just, I can be better. I can be the best. I can be a God, whatever stupid thing that they're coming up with. Mm-hmm. What are solutions that you can recommend that we can stop this process? Because it's being moved out in such a nefarious, underhanded sort of way.
I would challenge anyone who's listening to this and thinks that we're smoking dope to go to some of the places that I have cited. Look for yourself. I would also urge parents, if you think you're being told everything that's going on in your child's school, connected to their education, especially when it comes to interventions and behavior management and things like that, I'd start looking at who's doing it. How are they licensed? Are they licensed for what they're being treated for? What medications are being handed out, especially with or without your consent? Look at not only what you're opting out of, but what you're able to opt into, because that is something that the education system has done. Everybody knows about opting out of A, B, C, and D, but oh, if we make it reverse, where they don't know they can opt into something, you might be missing out. So I hope people understand that point. I would also urge them to look at their state budgets, to look at the Medicaid funding, to look at the special populations it is going to, as opposed to who it should be going to. Since it's known that schools are double dipping, that is a federal offense. You could absolutely bring out several lawsuits on this as well. And don't forget, because this impedes a child's civil liberties, that you have punitive recourse that is absolutely legitimate and legal under the Civil Rights Act of 1981, Section 1983, which tells you if anyone impedes your personal rights in any way, shape, form, or fashion, that you have a recourse. Now, because they've made it a personal affront to your personal rights, you need to make it personal when you seek recourse. So in other words, don't just go after the school board as a group. Go after every single member of the school board, because they made it personal and seek to harm you. And you are just trying to get a legal siding that says, wait a minute, you can't do that. And here's the thing that we need to understand about this particular civil rights section, Dr. Elena, is that it doesn't have to already have happened to you. It could be being planned for you if it any way impedes your life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness.
That's excellent to know. I think people feel intimidated to try to go against something that they feel is bigger than they are. But like I said about healthcare, it can't work without your child being in it. If you know, you can't work if doctors don't acquiesce to what's going on in the hospitals, it would stop. And at this point, we have the power. Nothing's mandated. Nothing's set in law, correct?
It is in some instances, but again, you would need to know specifically what it is that you're seeking to find out what is mandated. In other words, the Title I funding is mandated. So that means that universal screening is mandated. How it's carried out, though, you need to check, is that mandated or is that still up for, I can be a parent and I can go to my school board and say, hey, we need to talk about this.
Well, we have a minute left, but I want to start the question. I'm sure we'll go into it in our next part two of the show. But is there power in taking your child out of this system? I think it's Seattle, where so many parents were so disgusted about what was going on. They started homeschooling their kids, and now they have to let go of teachers. They're closing schools. They don't have enough money, because you do need the children in the seats to get money. Right. And it's changing their dynamic. Is that powerful enough to start the ball rolling?
It's a way, but where we need to be super, super careful, Dr. Elena, is because this system is involving the community. That means that even if you are outside of the system, they will find a way to put you into it, especially through healthcare. So I would say homeschool while you can. Be very wise to what is going on around you. Do not be Pollyannic about, I got Johnny and Susie out, everything's hunky-dory. No, you need to be as wise as serpents and as gentle as doves. And there will be a time when we don't need to be gentle, where we need to be forceful. Right now is not the time, because we need to be gathering the information so that we can formulate how best to attack the beast.
I couldn't have said it better. In the seconds that we have, Lynn, how can people reach you?
CommonCoreDiva.com is the best way to reach out to me if you need to leave a message. You can do that in a comment on one of the articles or any of the podcasts that I have. And you can always find me on the Liberty Bells as well. We do a live broadcast every Thursday morning at 11:30. So you can always find me there as well.
Lynn, you're the best. I really want to thank you for your time. As usual, I got an education, and I'm sure my listeners did too. And knowledge is power, and we have the power. We just need to access it and wield it. So once
Absolutely.
Again, Lynn, thank you so much. I really love you.
Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk Events.